Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich on Maui.
And I'm Chris Vandercook on Oahu.
It's Wednesday, June 11th from HBR2. It's The Conversation. Preventing a different kind of Olowalo massacre.
And is it art? Hubba hubba. Yowza. Yes, it is.
A Tarzan of the apiary.
Build a better trap set and the drummer will beat a path to your ears.
Plus the world view, too, from Deutsche Welle, a backyard taste of honey, and a lesson in irony in today's reality check.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Cynthia Matsky wonders how many times Hawaii needs the lesson that once a biological treasure is gone, there's no second chance, especially when that resource is an exemplary reefed habitat that's home to manta rays and 500-year-old coral. Ms. Matsky says it's lunacy to even consider urbanizing Maui's Olowalo Reef. The marine biologist, Scripps Master's candidate, and filmmaker is documenting the reef status to convince council members to change their decision, and she joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Bethan.
You know, when you look at the plans for Olowalo Town, and it looks, you know, pretty nice, and you've got affordable housing, you've got a nice community, small town, all those nice things a lot of people want. But the thing that you say that really isn't being looked at is the effect of this urbanization on the reef itself and what happens if this is destroyed.
That's a big part of it. There are the effects on the reef and putting almost 4,000 people. So when we're talking about scope, this is more than the entire population of Lanai. To put that number of people and to call it a town above a reef of such key biological significance, it's going to have devastating effects, not just for Olowalo Reef, but because it is a seed reef that keeps alive all of the different coral reefs around Maui County, from Lanai, Molokai, and around Maui as well.
So, yeah, and that's a big part of it, the fact that without the seed reef, you don't have much anything else flowing out from that. If you make this cogent argument, as you have over and over again, what in your mind has been keeping council members and others from really understanding that this is not such a good idea, according to you?
Well, it's actually a lot of the biologists and scientists that are making this argument, and I have been three different times to testify at the county council in rooms filled with the folks talking about the science. So I think it is just the desire for growth and part of the plan that looks at having low-income housing higher up on the top. However, the string of mansions along the front and cutting off access to the public, as well as the effects to the reef, to me that is a threat that cannot be justified.
Well, cutting off access to the public and, you know, what goes along the reef, you know, what kind of housing, all of that, seems to be immaterial to the idea that if you have runoff from urbanization and from development, that you're going to impact the reef below, and that's the central part of your argument.
Exactly. Coral needs clean, clear, low-nutrient water in order to be able to photosynthesize and to grow and to be that base habitat that a lot of the fish and species need in order to thrive and survive. So the siltation that can occur, and every single study has shown that when you do put a major development, the runoff will have that effect. Also looking at injection wells and the way that sewage and affluent will be treated, that has a huge effect on the reef. So there is a place for some development that can and needs to occur on Maui, but it needs to be done in a way that is not going to affect this crown jewel reef.
If it's such a crown jewel, why are people seemingly not paying attention to this, at least at the city council level?
That is the cause of frustration. And all I can say is the developers make a very good argument. However, when we're talking about something 500-year-old coral and so many species that are so key, I don't think putting one more development along Maui's shoreline, when it could be moved, it could be put in different areas. The area, Makai side of the highway, could be protected. Those are things that need to happen for the reefs and for all of Maui. So I think it's very short-sighted to look at putting something of that scope and scale there for short-term economic gain for a few, considering the ramifications it will have for all of Maui's reefs.
When you talk about the development runoff, what happens when you're actually developing that area, that's one thing. But once people are there and you have injection wells and you have all of what you have to have in place, all the infrastructure so people can continue to live there, what happens if you have an injection well?
Well, the seepage and the effluent that comes out will have an effect. It changes the dynamics. And so basically there are so many different things that are affecting the reefs now, from climate change to ocean acidification to coral disease. These are natural stressors from a global scale, but putting anthropogenic or human-based stressors right from off the shoreline, that is what is going to tip the balance. Reefs can be resilient, but we need to identify and protect a few key areas, and Oluwalu is that place.
You're making the point that there are some things that we can't change, we
yes.
can't necessarily impact in the way that we would like to or as quickly as we'd like to, but the bottom part of your argument really is, why make it worse?
Yes, this is something that we have control over. We can change, we can protect this area, we can give it the designation that it needs. Because those other stresses, we can document decay, but we can't change the bigger scale. We can, however, change what's happening in our backyard and protect this treasure.
Which is one of the reasons why you're involved with this HD film, to be able to capture what the reef looks like right now and hopefully use that to make the case to the council.
Exactly. A filmmaker by the name of Susan Cusero is doing a film called Afraid of the Dark, Humanity at the Crossroads, in which she interviewed me on a lot of the global threats going on to the ocean. And when we decided where to do the interview, I said, well, let's go to Oluwalu. And as I spoke about, you know, here in our own backyard, in a place like Maui, where you would expect that people know how key our environmental treasures are, and that people come from all over the world to see this. When we are making decisions here in a place that is supposed to be a little more evolved, that was just so shocking that the filmmaker offered to make a short film to try to reach people and touch them with the beauty while there is still time. And so another local videographer came forward and said, let me help you film, Greg Furstenworth. Let me help you get some of the underwater footage. So we're trying to capture these gems to, again, reach out to people that drive by it every day and maybe sit in traffic and know that something's going on there, but don't understand that that this is almost 2,000 homes.
And what happens when this film is done? When will it be done and shown to the council and anyone who wants to see it?
Well, hopefully in about the next month we'll get it produced. And we're working in cooperation with Akaku Community Television. And so they're going to help take the footage. We'll cut it together. And hopefully the footage will be able to take a few different forms into a documentary that will air on Akaku, go right into the hands of the council people, as well as developers, to let them know that hopefully this decision won't be their epitaph.
And on that note, we're going to let it be ours, at least for the moment. Thanks very much, Cynthia, for coming in, and good luck with the project.
Thank you, Bethan.
Cynthia Matsky is a Maui-based marine biologist. She's also a Scripps Master's candidate and director of Trilogy's Blue Aina campaign. She's advocated for ocean wildlife for 20 years, and the fight and documentary to keep Oluwalu undeveloped and home only to wildlife is her ongoing project.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
I love public radio because it makes me laugh, it makes me cry, it makes me think, it makes me squirm, It just is a wonderful thing for me, and I love being there in that space.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Later in the show, the Art of the Tease comes to the museum, and Tsunami Warning Center, move to lower ground now. What?
Since we'll be discussing bees later in the show today, we thought we'd start with a backyard quiz talking about birds. Honey creepers, to be exact. Honey creepers are endemic, too, that is, found only in Hawaii. These birds feed on nectar, have brightly colored plumage, and sing canary-like songs. At least 56 species of honey creeper are known to have existed. However, all but 18 are now extinct. The most recent example is the pouuli. It wasn't even discovered until 1973 when UH students found it on the northern slopes of Haleakala here on Maui. During the 1980s, its population dropped dramatically, and by 1997, only three were known to exist. In 2004, the last known living pouuli was taken from the wild with the hope of breeding it in captivity. However, a mate was never found, and this last representative of the species passed away in 2005. And for our backyard quiz question today, is this truly the end for the pouuli? We'll return with the answer a little later in the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm Laurel Swan from the University of Hawaii School of Architecture. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
The names alone should tell you you're in for an exotic evening. Lola Love, Violetta Beretta, Coco Electric, Miss Fortune. You're in the world of burlesque, where the glamour is laid on extra thick, and the names have been changed to protect the innocent. Or maybe innocence has nothing to do with it. Violetta Beretta is the organizer of the second annual Burlesque Festival and Review, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Violetta.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, as soon as I said that, I thought, you know, maybe innocence has everything to do with it, because burlesque seems kind of innocent in today's perspective, at least to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were just chatting about that, and I agree. You know, when people find out what me and my compatriots do, normally they're a little bit shocked at first until I say, well, do you watch MTV or cable or even network TV? And they say yes, and I say, well, you're probably seeing a lot more skins than you'll see on any of our shows, you know.
And seen it presented with a lot less mystery, too.
Well, yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. And we try to cloak or couch our performances in not only the feminine mystique, but also humor, creativity, sometimes political stuff. So it's a good format for creative people to express themselves. And you know, it doesn't only have to be about the tease, but it certainly helps when it is.
Well, it's got a long and hallowed tradition in American entertainment. How far back does burlesque go?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, actually, if we're going to talk about the origins of burlesque, it started in the early 1800s, I believe, with a troupe called Lydia and Her Famous Blondes, who was an English burlesque troupe.
Uh-huh.
But the nature of burlesque has changed throughout the years. It was more of a way of making political satire, and then throughout the ages, and
really?
Yeah, and more towards the vaudeville era, And then into the 50s and the 60s, it became more about the striptease. So, yeah, we've actually had a number of burlesque legends visit Hawaii. Lily St. Cyr, Tempest Storm, mm-hmm. were all brought in by a big-name burlesque promoter in the 50s, I believe. And so we've had some burlesque legends here already, and hopefully we'll have some on stage at the Doors Duke on Friday.
We're starting new legends as we speak.
Yes,
right?
We've been working on it.
But you have, and you mentioned people like Lily St. Cyr, who've put as much attention into creating a kind of a larger-than-life persona.
Correct.
It's a lot more than just slipping the gown off your shoulder. It's about the build-up to
yes.
it, right?
I mean, a lot of people, you know, when they watch, the intention is for it to appear effortless. So mm-hmm. if you're, you know, seeming like you're working really hard, you're probably not doing it right. And so they think to themselves, oh, this must be a very easy thing. But yeah. it's like any sort of show. You know, a lot of work does go into it. And some of the best performers I've seen, you know, not only are they conscious of their dancing and their sexiness, but their humor, their facial expressions, their choice of music, the story that they're telling. One of the girls that is going to be performing Coco Electric on Friday is a great storyteller. She's very compelling and has one of the best, most expressive faces I've ever seen mm-hmm. in a performance. So there's a lot there to appreciate just, you know, aside from the lack of clothing.
Well, I mean, it's, as I say, it's a show business tradition.
Yes.
There's a whole tradition of burlesque
yes.
comedy, the music, the presentation.
The Baggy Pants comedians.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a really, and it all kind of ties into vaudeville, the vaudeville era, when people would travel not only with singers, dancers, comedians, but also, you know, burlesque dancers as well.
You know, I've always kind of, I wasn't around for it, but in a way I kind of miss the vaudeville era in the sense that people all over America in medium to large-sized towns were theater performers. You could be a theater performer and remain quite active if your home base was Oklahoma City or
and
Kansas.
And make a living, yeah, sure. They had a circuit. And yet it's important to remember, though, that at this time, this was the, you know, there was no TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people relied on their visual stimulation and their, you know, night out to be at these theaters or wherever these shows happened to be, and that was their entertainment at the time. So it was easier, I think, for people to not only make a living, become popular, and engage audiences that way because there wasn't as much focus being pulled away by the TV and the internet. That said, though, it's coming back. People are starting to find that they enjoy going back to the theater, back to clubs and stuff. So there's been a huge revival in burlesque and vaudeville within the past 6-7 years.
Well, maybe it was a mistake to ever think that a three-dimensional live performer that you can look at right there on stage could be replaced by a flickering
sure.
two-dimensional image.
Totally. I mean, it's a completely different animal. And while I like both, there's nothing like live dancing and live music.
Well, and to keep that alive, what kind of, you know, where does it go from here? I mean, as opposed to being sort of a museum piece of the past, how do you make it contemporary and take it forward?
That's actually a great question. I am a senior member of a burlesque troupe, Cherry Blossom Cabaret. Mm-hmm. We're going to be celebrating our 7th birthday, actually, in a month or so. So we've been at it for 7 years and started out small in the Chinatown community when it was not so great, and actually have been around to witness and to help a little bit with their sort of urban revival.
Mm-hmm.
So as we move forward, we've, you know, gotten more people. We went from a small group to now a troupe of 11. We have interns. We have performers who travel regularly contacting us to come just visit our state and share.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of all culminated for me personally in doing the Hawaii Burlesque Festival because I wanted to show local audiences our awesome burlesque, local burlesque performers and showcase them and then give everybody an opportunity to see people who are, you know, U.S. mainland, international performers, and then also offer some kind of a, you know, workshops and stuff to help educate the community if they want to learn some things about it or, you know, just some skills, fitness, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're offering some workshops taught by some of the members of my troupe and some of the outside performers.
I would think self-confidence would play a pretty strong part in all this.
That's the main thing. You know, if you want to improve a little bit of your movement skills, walking, sexy and stuff. But the main thing with burlesque is that it's not one of my favorite things about it is that there is no one particular look. Everything is beautiful in its own way. So mm-hmm. if you're thin, large, big-breasted or small-breasted, it doesn't matter. You can still go out there and be appreciated and show your creativity and your artistic talent. So with these workshops, it's more about, you know, like you said, building confidence in the fact that you can put these gloves on and you know, just go
And maybe get a little bit outside of yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah? Larger-than-life kind of persona.
Exactly. And sometimes having a person tell you that that's okay is what makes it okay.
Well, it's definitely okay.
There's a lot of gentlemen that would also agree with you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Violetta Beretta presents the second annual Burlesque Festival and Review this Friday at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. And details are on our website, hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Theater, presenting Heaven Forbid, an adult comedy about two rebellious seniors who refuse to grow old gracefully, featuring Patty Duke and Joe Moore, June 20th through 30th, hawaiitheater.com.
Guitarist Jeff Peterson headlines a special concert in Windward Community College's Palikou Theater on Sunday, August 4th at 4 p.m. Jeff Peterson and Friends features Hoku Award winner Nathan Avell, jazz ukulele virtuoso Benny Chong, and classical guitarist Ben Verdery. Tickets are available to HPR members only until June 15th. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org and click on events. To order by phone, call 955-8821.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Stephen and Jacqueline Smith of Kailua Kona, Kathleen Bolger-Han of Waianae, and Gary Tasaka of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's irony in motion. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center is scheduled to move, but now there are questions whether the new site might be too vulnerable to the event it's supposed to help everyone survive. The big question is, can the Tsunami Warning Center survive a major tsunami? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Irony in motion. Nice phrase, Beth Ann. That seems to fit this story exactly.
Well, you know, the idea of moving the Tsunami Center to a place where hopefully it can do its job seems to be what, you know, the move is all about when you're talking about taking it out to Ford Island. It's getting to Ford Island that's the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem. We're talking about a $153 million state-of-the-art complex. It'll be a move there in about 6 months' time. And anybody that's been to Ford Island out there in Pearl Harbor, it's pretty darn flat. It's pretty much at sea level. And the concern is that, you know, what if a tsunami comes and swamps the island and strands people there? There's this report out by a watchdog group, and we have the story on our site, that says that bridge that connects the Oahu to Ford Island could be washed out either by a tsunami or a hurricane, and then you're going to have all those folks trapped there. That is their big concern.
So why would anyone even think about putting the Tsunami Warning Center there?
Well, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is really downplaying any problems with this idea of having the center out there. They say even if for some reason that bridge were disabled, there are water taxis used by the U.S. Navy there that could rescue
in a tsunami.
Yeah, exactly. And so they don't think that's a problem. Historically, there really isn't any evidence of tsunami damage. I think the big tsunami that was so destructive to us was back in 1946. Remember that one that really hurt the Big Island, Hilo in particular? Pearl Harbor only had a 5-foot surge, according to the Tsunami Warning Center. And so the feeling is that it's just not realistic that will be that the center will be in any kind of danger from a tsunami that, as you indicated, is supposed to help us survive.
So this may be more of an academic concern than an actual practical consideration.
That's right. I got to tell you this, the advocacy group does feel that NOAA should have a better evacuation plan. I'll just read from the watchdog's executive director. If NOAA's evacuation plan is too dangerous to even practice, it hardly inspires confidence that it will work in the midst of an emergency. But NOAA says it doesn't need to plan those practice drills. Really, there's a low likelihood, NOAA says, about a risk to any employees there at the center on Sword Island.
But we kind of have heard that story in other ways before. Well, we're going to wait and see what happens with this one, Chad. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Bethann. Take care.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lahm and Ryan Ozawa, and I've got Bert on the line. And Bert, we're going to take a look at the economy from the point of view of the people in a position to know a little bit about it, yeah?
Well, that is what we are going to talk about. You know, I've not had the chance to really delve deep with the folks over at UHERO. That's the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. And they do a lot of work with data that is being provided from a variety of different sources. And they take the data and they basically build some reports and some sort of analysis of that data, and I think it's an interesting topic, and I don't know if that as a resource. I think there's probably a lot of economists that look at the UHERO, but you know, from a general public standpoint, you know, do we all know that resource is there for us?
Well, it's part of their task is kind of taking all that data and making it comprehensible to the layman. Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. And another thing that caught my attention was there's a project that they're launching called the Dashboard Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it one of the first sort of visualizations was a breakdown of all the different types of jobs in Hawaii that kind of make up our economy. And the other thing that was interesting about that was that they were soliciting input from the community. So, you know, one of the things I definitely want to explore with them is what kind of input do they want to have from the community, and how is that dialogue going to continue with this dashboard project?
Well, Bert, good luck with that. It's going to be interesting to find out what you guys talk about. That's tonight at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Thanks, Chris.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Coming up, more bang in the rhythm of life and not-so-magical being on Maui.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honua Kai Resort and Spa on Maui, offering studios and 1, 2, and 3-bedroom suites dedicated to creating an experience where families and friends connect and make memories. HonuaKaiMaui.com.
There's better being on Maui, well, at least for the moment. As of now, Maui bees are free from varroa mite infestation, unlike Hawaii Island, Oahu, and Kauai. Agricultural steward Lloyd Fischel would be quick to add, it might happen yet on Maui. Last month, his farm was a co-sponsor of an informational exchange about colony collapse disorder, and he says no beekeeper on Maui should be complacent. Lloyd Fischel joins us this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Beth.
Bees are little creatures that, you know, you see them in the garden. We've talked about them many times before on the program. Not seeing enough of them, or really perhaps having enough people understand the key role they play in the food we all eat and the lifestyle that we enjoy.
That's correct. We're really have lack of understanding of bees. For example, we think of a bee as an individual unit, like an individual life, but the fact is a bee can't live without the colony. Just for several hours, if the bees are without a queen, they actually, their behavior changes and they have to then create a new queen or they actually perish. So when we look at bees, we have to think of the entire colony, and the strength of the colony is going to determine the success of the colony in surviving the many impacts that the environment brings.
And that seems to be rather a metaphor for the rest of us.
That is true. It's not only a metaphor, it's the truth. We just have a kind of rugged individualism mindset, which makes us think that we can live alone, but we really can't.
Considering that bees are responsible for pollination that results in about a third of what we need, you would think that maybe people might be a little bit more concerned about it. But some of the big criticisms in Hawaii have been that we haven't been concerned enough about colony collapse and that we didn't do enough in the beginning. Is that really valid, or do we not even have time to be talking about it at this point?
Oh, we have plenty of time, and there's many things that we can do. The future awaits us. If we don't think that way, then we have to think that the human race is just not going to make it.
For us to be able to perpetuate what the bees need to do in Hawaii. Now, clearly, Maui is in a position that the rest of the state isn't, and you've been very, very pointed in saying, look, just because they're not here now doesn't mean they won't get here yet. Do you think that that's going to be a certainty?
The important thing is that we're vigilant, and the conference that we held, Paul Apau of the Maui Queen Bee Company was the direct sponsor of the event a week or two ago. It was about strengthening the bee colonies by involving bees that are good cleaners, that they can really clean out those varroa mites from the hives. And by developing more and more of those kind of bees, we have a chance to win over the varroa mite. The problem with the pesticides, which stands to weaken the systems of the colonies, that's another problem. And all of us humans have to be very concerned about chemicals and pesticides if we hope to survive.
Talk to me about the bees that can clean out the varroa mite, because we don't really talk a lot or hear a lot about the fact that this can be something that happens with the bees themselves.
It's really, really amazing. I recently found out that honey is a medicine. Our society generally thinks of honey as a sweetener, and therefore bees are expendable because we have other kinds of sweeteners. But the fact is, honey is a medicine, and the function performed by bees in the field is very important, as you mentioned, for a third of our food in the contemporary world. Bees clean their hives, and that's why we can eat the honey that we eat raw. They clean the hives very well. They're very good cleaners. And some bees are better cleaners than others and actually clean out those little tiny mites that destroy the larva. It was those bees that Paul Apau of Maui Queen Bee Company has been interested in raising in order to export queen bees that have that capability of producing worker bees that actually clean the hives very well. And this is just the beginning of a long process, and it's very, very promising.
Hawaii is one of the queen bee capitals of the world, isn't it, still?
Yes, it is. More queen bees are exported from Hawaii than anywhere else in the world. At one time, at the turn of the 20th century, Hawaii was the largest producer of honey in the world, and we have every opportunity to revisit that, redevelop that in our state, and that's what we intend to do.
You seem to be a lot more optimistic about this than many of the voices that we have heard. But that's not something, again, that you want to have a great deal of complacency about, but just simply it's going to take some hard work to get there. What is it that you especially want other people who don't deal with bees every single day the way you do? What is it that you want the rest of us to know?
I think we have to recognize that the world is becoming increasingly dangerous because we're not involved, and we have to become involved. As a co-founder of the Farmers Union, I'd made it a personal determination to learn about these things, and that's how I learned about bees and determined that other people need to learn about bees too, many, many people, as many as possible, and in so doing, we'll improve our society, I believe.
You're really asking people to make some very distinct choices in what they do behaviorally and certainly where they spend their money.
We must do that.
And specifically, looking at labels and being concerned about what you're going to choose to purchase and what you're not is, you know, all the way up the line, not just perhaps do you get the best food value for your own body, but what you're doing to produce a society that produces better food value.
That's correct. If we continue to eat honey that's been refined and processed with heat, it has no enzymes, it's only a sweetener, we lose as a society. If we get honey that's raw, if we demand it, it can be produced right in our own backyard, meaning in any society, any area where the temperature is medium for bees, we can have raw honey and in that way strengthen our health as well.
Lloyd, when you and I talk to each other, let's say a year from now, what is it that you would like to see happen in this next year that would mean the health of bees?
I'd like to see the involvement of more people in the research that we're doing here in Maui to strengthen the queen bees, as well as to understand the effects of the poisons on the bees. That'll be a big step that the rest of the world can learn from.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Beth.
Lloyd Fischel is Lanikai's Farms owner. He's also the co-sponsor of last month's dialogue among experts from the U.S. and Japan about bee colony collapse disorder. He and the farm also received the Heroes of Agriculture 2010 Award from the state of Hawaii for excellence in educating society about sustainable and biologic farming, growing fish and vegetables. The link to Lanikai Farms is on our website, hpr2.org.
Backyard today, we stop to have a look at Hawaiian honey creepers. These endangered endemic birds descend from one ancestral finch species and, through time, evolved into 56 distinct species. 18 are still alive today. One species of honey creeper has had a very sad short span in relation to man. The pouuli was first discovered on the slopes of Haleakala back in 1973. But by 1997, only three individuals were still surviving in the wild. By 2005, the very last pouuli died in captivity. The hope had been to find a mate and breed this species to survivability, but it was not to be. So our question for today is this. Is there any hope for the pouuli? Well, there may yet be. The Bishop Museum has preserved the final pouuli as well as the first one ever discovered, and using the DNA from these birds, there may come a day when a pouuli could be cloned. Only time and science will tell. Thanks to Molly Hageman, Vertebrate Zoology Collection Manager at Bishop Museum, for today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, my name is Dr. Jerry Jampolsky, and you are listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
There's no single approach to jazz drumming that works in every context. Your job is to bring the rhythm to life, whatever the style and whatever the tempo, but it's a very different job in a piano trio setting from what's required of the big band drummer. It's one of Jeff Hamilton's great strengths that he's at home in both environments, able to support a trio without overpowering it, and capable of providing enough muscle to make his Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra into the most swinging unit of its kind in jazz today. We're lucky to have him in town for a trio performance tonight, even luckier to have him with us in our studio. Good morning, Jeff, and thanks for coming.
Good morning, Chris. Nice to be here.
You know, as you sit behind your drum kit, you've got the capability of making a little whisper quiet sound with your brushes, or you can go all the way to full on thunderous, you know, going around the tom toms and making an immense kind of noise. So that's a wide range of choices to have at any given time.
Yes, and can be dangerous in the wrong hands.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Not for the unwary to deal with.
True.
Right?
Yeah. True.
But that's where taste comes in, and it's am I correct in saying that thinking in terms of two other guys is a very different thing than when you're with your big band?
Yeah, there are a lot of different elements to that. You're first of all, with three people on the bandstand, you're exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So in a big band with 16 to, in our Clayton Hamilton, 19 pieces, there are places, if you choose, which I don't do, but there are places that a drummer can hide
mm-hmm.
in a big band. And in a trio, you're fully exposed all the time. You're one of three people. And especially with my trio, it's three equal parts. It's not a piano player
right.
with a bassist and a drummer sweeping up after the piano player, which a lot of trios do. It's mm-hmm. all about the piano player.
And nobody's being backed up.
Right. We're all present all the time. And mm-hmm. so it's a little different than most trios. So you're asked to express yourself, what kind of day you've had, your personality that you can bring to the music in both settings.
Mm-hmm.
One of the similarities is from Mel Lewis, that he shared with me. He was a dear friend and a mentor. And he said, just whoever you're playing with, no matter the size of the ensemble, make sure that you're thinking like being an oversized stuffed sofa that the band can sit on.
That's
you
great.
Want them comfortable to play.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
don't want them nervous and
uh-huh.
crazed. You know, you
uh-huh.
want them comfortable so they can play the best they can. So in either setting, you want to try to do the best to make everyone sound as good as they possibly can by being as relaxed as they can.
Well, you know, I sometimes think of the drummer's role as equivalent to or akin to that of the catcher on a baseball team. You
mm-hmm.
know, because they always say the catcher is the most important player because he's the only one who can see everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
mm-hmm.
that thing of pulling it all together from the drum chair. Do you feel that as part of your role?
Yeah, I do. And being a big baseball fan in my youth, I think that is a lot more so than a quarterback. You know, in football,
yes.
I think the catcher is a good comparison. You see the whole game. You have to be aware of everybody in the band. Mel Lewis, again, if you ever saw him play, he would look to his right to get the piano player and bass player involved.
Mm-hmm.
He'd look to his left to get the baritone saxophone player. He'd have the whole range of motion
right.
Under his awareness scope.
And I did see him perform a number of times. He's one of the great big band drummers mm-hmm. of all time. And there was that sense of cohesion coming from the rhythm section where it wasn't as if really he had Richard Davis on bass
mm-hmm.
when I heard him. And the sound, and I believe it was Horace Parlin, but the sound of that rhythm section was as if the three were a single instrument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the cohesiveness that you strive for. Yeah,
yeah, it was interesting in that it's sort of like a family
mm-hmm.
when you're playing. There's not one designated person to do one thing. It's if it's of high quality music that you're sharing your personalities with. For example, with Richard Davis, he could explore and go off wherever he wanted to and rhythmically or harmonically and just sort of do what he did. And whether it was Horace or Hank Jones or Roland Hanna,
mm-hmm.
they were asked to do whatever they do, and Mel, again, was the sofa,
mm-hmm.
you know, for them to sort of relax with. So they all sort of played within that rhythm section to make each other sound great. That's, again, there's that element that comes to the forefront.
And the players you describe were playing very, very free in
mm-hmm.
that context. Richard Davis was would go all over the place
mm-hmm.
on the bass,
mm-hmm.
and somehow it was made to work.
Well, somebody had to stay at home. And that was Mel Lewis.
That's, yeah.
And they love playing together. I played with Richard Davis once, and I did the same thing with him. Instead of everybody going crazy, I stayed at home.
Mm-hmm. So while he's on his mm-hmm. flights of invention, you just try to be cool
mm-hmm.
and keep the time.
Yeah, and enjoy what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So that requires a certain amount of maybe kind of self-effacement in that role, where it's the music rather than you that's at the fore.
Yeah, it's always serving the music is the first thought that comes to mind. I think a lot of young drummers who are brought up with rudimental drumming and mm-hmm. drum corps type technique, they get caught up in the chops and what they can display instead of serving the music and playing to make everyone else sound as good as they can. And once you learn that, you enjoy playing music so much better. But don't forget, there are some drummers who are never going to be musicians.
Yeah.
You know, there are drummers who own drum sets and want to display their technique.
Yes.
But I prefer to be thought of as a drummer, or a musician who happens to own a set of drums.
Well, that is an important distinction, and I can certainly think of times over the years playing music when you felt that the drummer behind you was kind of waiting for his moment to stick a roll in, right? Where, you know, it's kind of like you feel this tension in the back of your neck, like as we come to the chorus, it's like, I just know he's going to go bubba. Am I right? I
mean, yeah, that happens. But it also happens with a lot of other musicians. Instruments. It's not just the drummers.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the most noticeable probably. Yeah.
But what you're getting at in a sense is that saying that by serving the music and keeping the music at the fore, playing something that makes the music sound good, yeah, in a sense, by doing that, you're serving yourself. If you want to do a great job as a musician, make the music sound good, mm-hmm. and then by inference, you sound good.
Yeah,
right?
It's sort of like you set your standards for what needs to be done, and not for ego reasons, but just for if we're happy in life, you know, we try to do what we're going to do to make ourselves happy,
yeah.
in the right sense of the word. So I think this is just another part of that, where you do set the standards, where you have to meet your standards every night for you to be satisfied with what's going on musically, and keeping everyone else's standards in mind while you're doing that.
But, you know, also, Jeff, you've made me think of something, which is if you're happy in life, you don't have all that much to prove.
Right.
So in a way, your whole sort of sense of your being informs your music, in the sense of, like, I don't have to jump out here and be perceived as a great drummer.
Right.
I can just do the job that I'm here to do, right?
I prefer to look at playing music as offering my beat and my music to everyone in the band. I'm over that. But in high school, in college, you know, they're telling you to play rim shots and force the band to swing and, you know, go upside their head with a 2x4, and that's not what I do. I'm strong with my beat, and I'm confident about where it is, and I offer it to everyone in the band.
So there it is if you want to
there
take advantage
of it.
There it
is if you want to come on in, and then you offer it to the audience. And if they want to come in, as they just did on the Japanese tour, clapping on our grooves that they liked, on 2 and 4, very hip, you know.
That's you can't ask for more.
Right.
Jeff, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Good
I enjoyed
to have
it.
You.
All right, Chris.
Jeff Hamilton, drummer, will perform tonight with Bruce Hamada on bass and Tamir Hindleman on piano at Studio 909 in Honolulu. And you can learn more at our HPR2.org website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the week-long Aotearoa New Zealand Film Festival, opening this Saturday with the documentary Maori Boy Genius. Learn more at honolulumuseum.org. Singer Roz Cohen will transport you to Piaf's Paris, Bryce's Borscht Belt, the New York Broadway stage, and the San Francisco cabaret scene during an evening of klezmer, cabaret, and all that jazz. She's bringing her unique talent to HPR's Atherton Saturday, June 22nd at 7:30, with sidemen Josh Kay at the piano and Bill Noble on reeds and winds. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
Beth Ann, earlier in the show, you talked to Lloyd Fischel about colony collapse disorder, and this is something that's affecting beekeepers throughout the island. Apparently, so far, Maui is is safe, but there's no reason to be complacent, because this whole idea of what's happening to bee colonies is a kind of a bellwether indicator of the state of the environment in general, yeah?
That's his whole point, Chris, that we have to sit up and take notice. This is not just some little creature that exists in isolation. And he told the story about what happens with an individual bee who may get separated, and the fact if they can't create a new queen or find one, somehow they become completely disoriented and they will die. So he says it's more than just a metaphor for the rest of us. It's just reality. And that's going to do it for us for today, for This Reality, coming to you from both Maui and Oahu. Thanks so much to FIM Group for letting us again borrow their conference center. And we'll be back here tomorrow talking about Maui's job in combating invasive species.
And we'll take a look inside the world and the traditions of the Pau Rider.
You can talk back to your radio, find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want me, I'm at BCauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We're going to feast on a little Maui agriculture and be back with you right here tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.